On Thursday evening, November 30, 1780, a group gathered in Philadelphia at the house of France's emissary to the American government. The occasion was a dinner party given to welcome the Chevalier, later the Marquis de Chastellux, who, having landed in Newport, Rhode Island in July of that year, had gradually made his way southward for a fortnight in Philadelphia. A soldier by early vocation and training, Chastellux served as Major General on the Comte de Rochambeau's staff, earning the right to be present the following October for the climactic surrender of the British Army at Yorktown. Quite as important as his participation in our revolutionary struggle, he was a keen observer of the American scene, and in that role, he possessed special qualifications. An aristocrat, a philosophe, a published author of note, a member of the Académie Française, he had, unlike many of his countrymen who took up arms in the American cause, a fluent command of English. Chastellux kept a record of his American adventures, places he visited, the local customs of people he met and spoke to, of gossip he collected. Not without his prejudices, strong distaste for Quakers and their peace testimony being one example, he nevertheless had privileged access to the leaders of the American Revolution, including George Washington, as well as to the upper echelons of American society, all as reflected in his travels in North America in the years 1780, 1781, and 1782. It was a mixture of French and Americans who attended the dinner party on November 30. Chastellux entered in his journal a thumbnail sketch for each of them. One of the guests was Samuel Powell, and about the first occupant of the Powell house, he had this to say. A man of considerable fortune, but without any part in the government, his attachment to the common cause having hitherto appeared rather equivocal. That remark, if we pause to think about it, raises a question that is today seldom asked at the Powell House, which is, where did Samuel Powell stand on the great issue of independence? In more than one guidebook currently in circulation, Powell is hailed as Philadelphia's patriot mayor. So he is identified by the Philadelphia Society for the Preservation of Landmarks on its website. So also does the Historical Society of Pennsylvania recognize him in the comprehensive finding aid to the Powell family papers that it holds, paying tribute to Samuel Powell as the patriot mayor who sided with the colonies during the Revolution. Samuel Powell was twice mayor of Philadelphia, each time for a brief interval. He served in that capacity from October 1775 to July 4, 1776. In 1789, following a long period when the office stood vacant, he returned as the first duly appointed mayor after the Revolution. For him to qualify, therefore, as Philadelphia's patriot mayor, he would have had to display his patriotic colors in 1775 or 1776. And based on all that we know, it is impossible to attribute to Powell any visible revolutionary fervor during those 2 years. Why does it matter, you may ask, whether at this early stage in the Revolution we label Samuel Powell a Tory or a patriot or something in between? No one has ever claimed that he played a major role in the conflict, or that, though of an age still young enough to do so, he thought of volunteering to serve as an officer in the American Army. Moreover, to be fair about it, Chastellux was plainly in error when he stated that as late as November 1780, Powell's attachment to the revolutionary cause appeared equivocal. Chastellux wrote in French, "Jusqu'ici," which I would translate as "until now." By then, Powell had openly sided with the Americans in their fight for independence. Both he and his wife had become friends of George Washington, whose presence at their house in January of 1779, we can verify thanks to a letter Benjamin Franklin's daughter sent to her father. Sally Franklin Bache reported to Franklin, then away in France, that she had been the general's dancing partner that evening, right in what we call sometimes this ballroom. There is, of course, a concern about historical accuracy. How essential do you regard it in interpreting history, the history of this house, that we present Samuel and Elizabeth Powell as they were, and not as we might wish them more heroically to be? Is poetic license ever a resource that guides may draw upon in order to make the experience of visitors to the Powell House a more memorable one? That concern aside, I suggest that by pursuing an inquiry about where Samuel Powell stood during the critical testing period of the British occupation of Philadelphia from late September 1777 to mid-June of 1778, we may gain a deeper insight into the revolution as an internal conflict and the challenge of allegiance that many people of that time had to face. In celebration of our national identity, we tend to forget that so-called loyalists, then popularly referred to as Tories, Benjamin Franklin preferred to call them royalists, constituted a sizable segment of the American population opposed to the revolution. John Adams put the number of loyalists at a third of the total population of the former colonies. Modern scholars lean toward an estimate closer to 20%, but even at that level, we are talking about roughly 500,000 people, some of whom, at the risk of their lives and having lost all their property, were forced to flee and find refuge elsewhere in the British Empire once the war was over. There were, to be sure, gradations of commitment both for the revolution and against it, ranging from taking up arms to nurturing a private, closely guarded hope about the outcome of the conflict. Such a commitment of whatever degree was subject to change as the fortunes of war changed. When the British Army, under the command of General Sir William Howe, landed at the head of the Chesapeake Bay in August of 1777 and began moving northward, the area in and around Philadelphia became a testing ground, not simply in a military sense as a theater of war, but as a time and place for individuals to decide where they stood on achieving independence. Before trying to determine how Samuel Powell approached that question, I owe you context in order to situate him more securely in 18th century Philadelphia. As an occasional guide at the Powell House, I have to admit that I have found him an elusive, stolid character. We seem to have, curiously, a more reliable view of him as a distinct personality prior to 1769, the year in which he became the owner of this property and the husband of Elizabeth Powell, Elizabeth Willing, than afterward. Born in 1738, Samuel Powell was a birthright Quaker. His grandfather, Samuel Powell, of Welsh lineage, arrived in Philadelphia in 1685, an orphan aged 12, in the care of his maternal aunt and her husband. This first Samuel Powell would prosper as a carpenter, a merchant, a respected member of the Society of Friends, and a person of consequence in Philadelphia society. He would accumulate in his ownership some 90 houses, representing the principal source of the wealth that he passed on to his grandson. His own son, the second Samuel, also prospered as a merchant, but died in 1747, 9 years before his father did. You can see that the third Samuel Powell, the focus of our attention, had privileged status from the very start of his life. We get an early glimpse of him as a young graduate of the College of Philadelphia about to embark for England. In October 1760, the college's provost, William Smith, addressed a letter of introduction to Thomas Penn, a son of William Penn and Pennsylvania's absentee proprietor in London, in which Smith had this to say of Powell. He enters into the world with an estate of near £40,000, added to the spirit of economy, and he has had a liberal education at our college, where he has taken his bachelor's degree. Both his fortune and his talents point him to become one of the most considerable and independent men in this government. With respect to his principles of religion and government, this is still Provost Smith writing, he well knows that we have ever left to him and his own judgment, and we hope that judgment, with the advantages of a liberal education, will always enable him to make a right choice. Smith, an ordained Anglican cleric, is tipping his hand concerning the religious destination that he hopes his former student will reach of his own accord. While staying abroad for a period of extraordinary duration, some 7 years, Samuel Powell would have gratified Provost Smith by shedding his Quaker birthright and joining the Anglican Communion. From letters he sent home and from travel journals he kept, we can understand how hard it must have been for Powell to return to Philadelphia after 7 relaxed, enjoyable years abroad. He was summoned home by his uncle, who had grown weary of managing Powell's estate in his absence. Not only did he have to relieve his uncle of this task, but the time had come to assume that place in society and government that Provost Smith had predicted for him. And of equal urgency, he felt pressure to begin working on producing the next generation of Powells who would succeed to the family wealth. We sense him moving almost overnight from being carefree and outgoing to careful and guarded in his conduct. Like her husband, Elizabeth Willing Powell was born into privileged status as the daughter of Charles Willing, a wealthy merchant, and his wife Anne, the latter a member of the influential Chippin family. I think it fair to conclude that tension developed in the relationship between Samuel and Elizabeth Powell because of Elizabeth Powell's failure to give birth to children who survived infancy. I sought to cast sympathetic light on how that failure affected both of them in the slender volume of mine published by the American Philosophical Society in 2006, A Portrait of Elizabeth Willing Powell. This provided by way of background, we are now ready to consider the question of Samuel Powell's patriotism. Significant obstacles confront us, however, in attempting to obtain access to Philadelphia and the Powell household during the critical time of the British occupation. Those who remained in Philadelphia self-censored what they put in writing because the authorities on both sides often opened personal letters for inspection. In the many illuminating collections of family papers at the Historical Society, there are gaps of silence that can only be explained by the discretion correspondence exercised or by their subsequent elimination of material that they regarded as compromising. Even so, notwithstanding the absence of revealing disclosures in the Powell papers for that period, we are going to enter the Society Hill neighborhood in which the Powells live and meet residents that they knew and would have frequently encountered when the British controlled the city. Here are some markers to guide us. The Willing family mansion at the corner of 3rd Street and Willing's Alley, a short distance north of the Powell House. It was built in the late 1740s by Elizabeth Powell's father, Charles Willing, a successful Philadelphia merchant, and occupied by his son, Thomas Willing, and a growing family after Thomas Willing's marriage in 1763. Southward, still on the west of 3rd Street, the Chew Mansion and its ample lot and outbuildings next door to the Powell House, just this side of the Powell House. William Byrd III of Westover, Virginia, acquired this property after he married Elizabeth Powell's sister, Mary. Byrd completed building the house by the end of 1762, and thereafter it passed through a succession of different ownerships, including that of the provincial governor, John Penn, until Benjamin Chew acquired it in 1771 for the enormous sum of £5,000. The Powell House. We're hearing it. Immediately adjoining the Chew Mansion on the west side of 3rd Street. Paul purchased the newly constructed house from Charles Stedman, together with its outbuildings and a lot going through to 4th Street. This property extended from 3rd to 4th Street at the time of the Paul ownership. In early August 1769, just a few days before he exchanged vows with Elizabeth Willing in Christ Church, Paul paid £3,150, the entire proceeds of sale being applied to discharge debts that Stedman had incurred in acquiring the property and in constructing the house. From the Paul House southward to Spruce Street, nothing but open space prior to and during the Revolution. In the period of interest to us, the Pauls had, like it or not, a ringside seat when British troops regularly used this area as a parade ground. On the other side of 3rd Street, at the northeast corner of 3rd and Pine, diagonally across from St. Peter's Church, a mansion belonging to the Reverend Jacob Duché. The rector of St. Peter's, Duché eventually became the rector of the United Churches of Christ Church and St. Peter's. He officiated at the marriage ceremony of Samuel Paul and Elizabeth Willing in 1769. Two final stops in this neighborhood tour, first on the west side of 2nd Street, between Spruce and Union, now Delancey Streets, the home of Charles Stedman, the first owner of what we now call the Paul House, and then on the west side of 4th Street, south of Walnut, opposite the western end of Willing's Alley, the home of Edward Shippen Jr. With the exception of Charles Stedman, all of these neighbors were on close terms with Samuel Paul and his wife. With the exception of Benjamin Chew, all of them remained in Philadelphia once the British took possession of the city in late September 1777. And all of them, without exception, were suspected of being Tories of one shade or another. During the 9 months of the British occupation, they would have inevitably met each other in circumstances allowing them to reflect on unfolding events and on conduct that prudence counseled each of them to follow. Yet, deprived of diary entries and correspondence from that time, I will occasionally put words in their mouths that I think they might plausibly have uttered. These neighbors were present as established fact, not faxy invention. At the last formal commencement held at the College of Philadelphia before the Revolution interrupted college life, Thomas Willing, Benjamin Chew, Samuel Paul, Jacob Duché, and Edward Shippen were members of the board of trustees of that institution. As trustees, they were duty-bound to show up at the large gathering at College Hall on May 17, 1775, a mere 4 weeks after the shot heard around the world rang out in Concord. Since the Second Continental Congress was then meeting in Philadelphia, the trustees invited the members of Congress to attend the commencement, which the delegates accordingly did, proceeding in a body from the State House to College Hall, located three blocks away at the corner of 4th and Arch Streets. The provost received them at the gate and directed them towards seats reserved in a crowded assembly room, which the trustee minutes report was filled with as many of the most respectable inhabitants of the city as could find room. After an opening prayer and anthem, degree candidates delivered a series of orations. The Chief Justice of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Chew, would have stirred with a mixture of pride and apprehension when he heard his son, Benjamin Chew Jr., pledge in a valedictory address to an assembly of patriots, and here again, this is an exact quote, that we who have this day been so highly distinguished in their fight will make our country good, and the support of her religion, her laws, her civil rights, the grand object of all pursuits. We will consider liberty as the choicest gift of heaven, the unalienable right of mankind, a little bit in anticipation of Thomas Jefferson, exalting human nature and inspiring every nobler sentiment. and we will devote ourselves to our service, not with a sudden or occasional zeal, but with a pure, steadfast, and inextinguishable flame, burning still clearer and stronger through life. According to the minutes and subsequent newspaper accounts, these patriotic sentiments, having expressed reference to the present interesting situation of public affairs, provoked loud and general applause, a sure sign that what was so eloquently proclaimed met with an advocate in every bosom. May we not therefore credibly construct some such exchange afterward between two neighbors that live next to each other on 3rd Street, Axe's invention. That was a fine speech your son gave, Mr. Chief Justice. I should thank you, Paul, but for my concern that the easy eloquence of youth fails to calculate the danger of the struggle ahead and the sacrifices that I foresee will be painfully exacted of us. For the residents of Philadelphia, including the Pauls and their neighbors, hard reality was indeed about to set in as the movement toward independence gained momentum. Thomas Willing, Paul's brother-in-law, and his senior by about 7 years, was one of the Pennsylvania delegates chosen to debate and ultimately to vote on this momentous issue in Congress. Thomas Willing was by temperament and training a cautious conservative. Upon his father's death, he succeeded to a prosperous mercantile business conducted under the name of Willing and Morse. He had received education in England that qualified him as a bencher at the Inner Temple, giving him the rare distinction when later appointed a justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court of being truly learned in the law. When it came time to vote on independence, the Pennsylvania delegation was badly split. Willing was one of those who voted against severing ties with the mother country, in part because he feared that the colonies were unprepared for war, both financially and militarily, and in part because the lawyer in him thought that the instructions that the delegates had received from the Pennsylvania Assembly did not authorize his affirmative vote. Did Willing ask his brother-in-law Samuel Powell for advice on this subject? Though Powell was then serving as mayor of Philadelphia, a largely ceremonial office, he had studiously avoided involvement in the polemical fray, and on this mixed question of law and conscience, Willing probably reached a decision on his own. Or if he sought advice, it is more likely that he turned to Robert Morris, that influential partner of his in the firm of Willing and Morris. Morris, also a member of the Pennsylvania delegation to the Second Continental Congress, shared Willing's misgivings but finally brought himself to vote for independence and sign the Declaration. In the conflict that ensued, Samuel Powell got an unexpected jolt. James Molesworth, a Philadelphia native, was arrested as a British spy and tried for treason before a military tribunal. He confessed his treasonable plotting, and in the presence of a large crowd, he was hanged on March 31, 1777. Molesworth's burial spot became a symbol of shifting allegiances. When taken down from the gallows, his body had been unceremoniously dumped in the potter's field, only to be disinterred and reburied in the Quaker burial ground once the British occupied the city. Then, as soon as the British left, indignant Whigs forced those involved in Molesworth's relocation to repent and reverse their prior action. The restless Molesworth thus surfaced again. His body was removed from the Quaker burial ground and returned to the potter's field, giving the poor man, in the space of 18 months, 3 interments and 2 disinterments. In light of this underground mobility, the name of Molesworth strikes me as a peculiarly apt one. What, however, would have unnerved Samuel Powell was the knowledge that James Molesworth, a convicted traitor, had served him and the previous mayor as their clerk. These neighbors in Society Hill engaged in serious soul-searching as the British forces drew near to Philadelphia in September 1777. Should they leave now or stay and make the best of it during the British occupation of the city? For those who had openly sided with the Patriots, like Tench Francis Jr., whose wife Anne was Elizabeth Powell's older sister, the question answered itself. Francis had no choice but to leave town. Wealthy men like Samuel Powell and Thomas Willing, who had maintained a more neutral stance, had strong incentive to stay and protect their property investments. Provided that they did not feel themselves at great personal risk vis-a-vis the British. How they may have gone about measuring such a risk, and whether directly or through intermediaries they obtained any assurance in advance from the British commanding officer, General Sir William Howe, are matters for conjecture. Benjamin Chew, Chief Justice of the recently disbanded Provincial Supreme Court, and Powell's neighbor, had acted as trusted counsel for the Penn family. Chu was deemed sufficiently suspect in his loyalties that a month before the British arrived in Philadelphia, the Supreme Executive Council, the executive authority established under Pennsylvania's new radical constitution, sent Chu and John Penn, the deposed provincial governor, into exile in New Jersey, where they remained in custody for most of the British occupation. That left young Benjamin Chu, the firebrand orator who spoke so eloquently at his college commencement 2 years earlier, in nervous charge of the house on Third Street and of his mother and several sisters by his father's two marriages, one of whom, a teenager, was already the much admired Peggy Chu. Before he went into forced exile, the Chief Justice may be heard asking Samuel and Elizabeth Powell to keep a watchful eye on the house next door, Maxie Invention. Ben is a good lad, but he'll need help while I'm away. I ask you, Mrs. Powell, out of friendship, to assist my wife in looking after the girls, who remain a particular source of worry to me. I have intimated that those in this neighborhood who stayed in Philadelphia may have communicated at some point with the British and the British commanding officer, General Howe. Acting in good faith, but reinforcing the suspicion about his loyalist sympathies, Thomas Willing sought to broker a negotiated peace by entering into conversations with Howe. When the proposed terms were relayed to Washington, Washington firmly rejected them. I am surprised, wrote Washington in November 1777 to the President of the Continental Congress. I am surprised that Thomas Willing would suffer himself to be imposed on by such flimsy measures. Chew and Morris were not present for Willing to consult before taking the step. Samuel Powell was, and his brother-in-law might have said something to him like the following, Maxie Invention. You know, Powell, that this war is ruinous to commerce and our interests. The Crown is guilty of having badly misread the situation in this country, but don't you think it's worth trying now to bring this conflict to a decent end by talking to Howe? The Reverend Jacob Duché, another Society Hill neighbor, turned out to be a tragic figure, subject to erratic and conflicting bouts of conviction. Living two blocks away from the Powells, and often the clergyman conducting Anglican services they attended, he was a frequent guest at their house. Elizabeth Powell recalled in the letter she sent to him in 1783, the copy of it is downstairs, among other things that I hope you will have the opportunity to take a look at if you get a chance. Elizabeth Powell recalled in the letter she sent to him in 1783, the 1,000 hours we have passed at our fireside with you in innocent and instructive conversation. When the British took possession of Philadelphia, Duché fell under suspicion as chaplain to the Continental Congress, who had delivered a prayer of impassioned patriotic content at the opening session of that body in 1774. The British arrested him as a patriot sympathizer, but after a night in jail and assurances supplied by General T. to General Howe by Duché's friends, maybe Samuel Powell. He was released. Shaken by this experience, he quickly switched sides and wrote to Washington a letter he would live to regret, saying in so many words that Washington was surrounded by incompetence, that the game was up, and that the true measure of Washington's leadership would henceforth be found in his admitting that he had been on the wrong side of history. Given the close relationship that existed between the Powells and Duché, we must wonder whether during the many hours of innocent and instructive conversation at the Powell House, as Elizabeth Powell put it, Duché disclosed the injudicious message he was about to send off to Washington. Probably not, for it appears to have been a piece of his own inspiration that he would have had difficulty explaining even to indulgent friends like the Powells. By turning to one surviving letter we have from Elizabeth Powell to her sister Anne Frances, dated April 2, 1778, and to the ledger book that Samuel Powell meticulously kept, we are able to gain partial entry to the household, to their household, during the months when the British were in control of the city. I begin with a letter, a copy in her handwriting of the letter she actually sent, which is in the Powell papers at the Historical Society. Her sister, almost 10 years older than Elizabeth Powell, had taken refuge with her husband, Tench Francis, and their children in property that Francis owned in New Jersey, ironically called Paradise. Francis, a successful merchant from a distinguished family, supported the revolutionary cause and found it uncomfortable, as I've already mentioned, to stay in Philadelphia once the British took over. In her typically ornate style, Elizabeth Powell undertook to answer two letters she had previously received from her sister. She pleaded as an excuse for her delay in replying, a certain irksomeness that I have to write at this time when our letters are liable to be read by every impertinent, an inhibition that generally affected correspondence both in and out of Philadelphia. Elizabeth Powell complained about her husband's rage for keeping fires going in this house, which she thought made her vulnerable to catching cold when she went out. Her husband dismissed her complaints about the heat generated in the fireplaces he stoked as due to bad nerves on her part. She reported on a trip that she had made to the townside estate which the Francises owned on the outskirts of the city and which the British had sacked. She had hoped that she might be able to salvage at least some of the furniture, but to no avail, for devastation was begun, and I really turned from it with grief. She sympathized with the heavy loss that poor Mr. Francis had sustained, hoping that he would someday recover what his honest industry seems to have entitled him to. Her sister, she worried, was suffering from being cut off from living society and the sensible, well-bred people that we have been accustomed to move in that we've been accustomed to move in the same walk of life with ourselves, which rather implies in my reading that Elizabeth Powell may likewise have felt that deficit. Anne Frances had asked her sister to inquire about a friend's mother who had disappeared in Philadelphia. Elizabeth Powell wrote that she had been unable to locate this missing person, but added in a glimpse of conditions prevailing during the British occupation that she cannot have wanted necessaries if she had been in Philadelphia all this winter. Reassurance verifiable from other sources that the comparative plenty available to those in the Powell's privileged class protected them. Powell's ledger book, the second means of gaining access to the Powell household, is a large, heavy folio volume covering the period 1760 to his death in 1793, and containing detailed entries about income and outgo. It confirms that the Powells lacked neither the necessities nor the comforts of life during the long winter of 1777-1778. In the ledger book, one may trace, for example, the investment made in firewood, a scarce commodity to maintain the level of heat that Elizabeth Powell found stifling. In 1777, Samuel Powell paid Robert Irvin £30 for 55 cords of wood. And in January 1778, he paid James Reynolds for more wood that Reynolds brought from Townside, the Francis estate. Just think of those piles of wood stacked up in the rear yard of the Powell house, a far cry from the appearance of a manicured English garden that it has today. There is one entry in the Powell Ledger book that I have to share with you, even though it has nothing to do with the issue of Samuel Powell's patriotism. It is a sad fact associated with his house's history that the Powells lost two sons, both named Samuel, one who survived for a year after his birth in 1770, and the second who died within a week or so after his birth in 1775. Discovery when I got into the ledger book. On April 18, 1772, 9 months after the first son died, Samuel Powell recorded in the ledger book payment he'd made to the joiner George Claypool for a coffin for my daughter, who, never baptized as her two brothers were, was in all likelihood a stillbirth. This entry adds to the weight of recurrent personal tragedy that the Powells experienced in their marriage, a sense of loss that would continue to haunt them both for years to come. For the British, the Philadelphia campaign came to an abrupt, inglorious end. General Henry Clinton replaced Howe in May and moved immediately to leave Philadelphia. Those Americans who had collaborated with the British had every reason to be concerned about their fate if they remained in the city, and many of them scrambled to leave with the departing British forces. But even in the turmoil of this impending departure, the dashing but unfortunate Major John Andre, who 2 years later would die on the gallows as the intercepted go-between in the Benedict Arnold conspiracy, planned one last hurrah, arranging with his fellow officers for an elaborately staged send-off for General Howe. Known in history as the Mechianza, it would be a long-standing subject of controversy and recrimination because of its extravagance and the visible involvement of members of the Philadelphia social elite. The British officers had little trouble in persuading 14 attractive young women from suspected loyalist families to don fancy dress and join in this once-in-a-lifetime event. Benjamin Chew's daughter, Peggy, was one of Andre's most enthusiastic accomplices. Although the three dazzling daughters of Edward Shippen, Jr., a cousin of Elizabeth Powell and a prominent lawyer and judge under the former provincial government, were much admired by the British officers and were decked out ready to go, family tradition has it that Judge Shippen put his foot down and refused his daughter's permission because of the indelicacy of their costume. He had already allegedly reprimanded a brazen young lord for kissing his daughter Sally in the street in front of their house. It should not surprise us to learn that Elizabeth Powell expressed her own strong view about the wisdom of allowing her young Shippen cousins to participate in this bacchanalia. Molly, you will serve as a witness to the fact that the library company has in its open room, the Logan Room, a mirror from the site of the Mechianza, a wonderful mirror, which I really wish could talk, for then we would know who was there that night. Just as the British were preparing to pull out, the evacuation was momentarily put on hold. In early June, a commission appointed by Lord North and headed by the young Earl of Carlisle arrived in Philadelphia to negotiate, if possible, an end to the revolution. The Powells had previously avoided the billeting of British officers, but now the Earl of Carlisle moved into the Powell House. He and his entourage displaced the Powells for a limited period of no more than 10 days, probably requiring them to relocate to the rear of the house. The guides have them relocated into that portion of the mezzanine. Carlyle wrote in a letter about his temporary occupancy and the cordial relationship that this English grandee formed with Samuel and Elizabeth Powell. Exact quote. "I'm lodged in one of the best houses in town, and indeed it is a very excellent one, perfectly well furnished. I am not, I own, quite at my ease, for coming into a gentleman's house without asking his leave, taking possession of the best of all the best apartments, and placing a couple of sentries at the door, using his plate, etc., etc., are very repugnant to my disposition. I make him and his wife a visit every day, and we are the best of friends in the world. They are very agreeable, sensible people, and you would never be out of their company." Charles Stedman, the first owner of the Powell House, offered it for sale in 1766 because of mounting debts, and also perhaps because of the recent death of his wife, Anne Graham Stedman. A loyalist, Stedman presumably welcomed another member of the Carlisle Peace Commission, Governor George Johnstone, as a guest at his house on 2nd Street. While staying at Stedman's house, Johnstone made the mistake of proposing a bribe to a leading patriot and member of Washington's staff, Joseph Reed. "If I could count on your continuing patience, we might take a closer look at Stedman's strange career and connections, but it's time, to your relief, to wrap things up." So in summary, how should we judge Samuel Powell? Was he a closet Tory, or a low-profile patriot, or neither? How accurate was the Marquis de Chastellux in his judgment at the end of 1780 that Powell's past attachment to the revolutionary cause should be deemed lukewarm? Accurate enough, I would submit, until the British left Philadelphia. Samuel Powell proceeded with caution and discretion, seemingly ready to accept whatever the struggle's outcome might be, but resolutely refusing to take sides until he can see more clearly the road ahead. We have one final telling example of Samuel Powell's sense of timing. 3 days after the Meccianza, Thomas Willing, Edward Shippen, and Samuel Powell met to take stock of their positions. They would have weighed the risks and uncertainties to which they would be exposed when the American army replaced the British in Philadelphia. Until mid-May of 1778, each of them had resisted taking an oath of allegiance, whether to the crown or to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. A year earlier, the Pennsylvania legislature had prescribed in statutory form the loyalty oath that all male inhabitants above the age of 18 were required to take. Patriots, who from the outset had clearly rallied to the revolutionary cause, took the oath in 1777 before the British arrived on the scene. Severe disabilities followed under the statute for everyone of age who refused or neglected to forswear allegiance to the crown and to swear allegiance to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. These three neighbors, bound by family ties and common financial concerns, had come to the conclusion that they could no longer remain neutral. Each of them proceeded to take the statutory oath and sign a document stating that he had done so, which the other two witnessed. The following day, they sought out a magistrate empowered to act by the Commonwealth, an official not so easy to find, by the way, in Philadelphia, still occupied by the British, who duly certified the completion of these formalities as required by law. The Historical Society of Pennsylvania possesses the very document signed by Samuel Powell on May 22, 1778, and witnessed by Edward Shippen Jr. and Thomas Willing, along with the necessary supporting certificate that John Knowles, a Justice of the Peace, supplied on May 23, copies downstairs on the table. Then, and then only, may we say that Samuel Powell's attachment to the common cause ceased to appear in the words of the Marquis de Chastellux, rather equivocal. Thank you very much.